Welcome to Verity Ed, where parents are primary. Today, I am so excited to have Mrs. Leah Labresco Sargent on. And Leah is an adult convert to Catholicism and a freelance writer. She covers religion, statistics, feminisms, and family, among many other interests. And her writing has appeared in the New York Times, First Things America, The American Conservative, Commonweal, The American Interest, and others. I'm sure there's more in the list as of this writing. She's the author of Arriving at Amen, Seven Catholic Prayers That Even I Can Offer, which tells the story of how she learned to pray. And her second book, Building the Benedict Option, which came out in 2018, I believe, yes, is a guide to building thicker Christian community. We're going to dig into what that means. What is thicker? And she runs two Substacks currently, which I enjoy tremendously. The Tiny Book Club, which is a tiny book club, no fraud in that advertising, where she picks interesting articles or essays for discussing each month, and Other Feminisms, which is a community focused on the dignity of interdependence. I think Pope John Paul II, were he alive, would really get a kick out of that, and Dita Stein too. They probably do from where they're sitting. She lives in New Jersey with her husband, Alexi Sargent, and baby Beatrice. I am so happy to welcome you, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure. So today, what I would like to do is try and tie in all of these deep ideas about, the vocation of women, the family, the Benedict option, and tease them out for homeschooling families or families considering homeschooling or trying to raise Catholic kids in this kind of crazy culture, and give them some practical and concrete ways that we can actually live this out in our lives. So it's going to be a great conversation. I'm very excited. So to kind of start out, people hear Benedict Option and they may or may not have read the book. They might have just read articles about the book, but it came out years ago and then your own book came out in 2018. Could you just summarize for everyone sort of your take on what Rod Dreher meant by the Benedict Option and sort of how you built on that in your own work?
The Benedict Option is at its heart a project of renewal. You know, Rod's drawing from the example of the Benedictine monks, you know, who by forming these communities sustained the church in a difficult time, but more than just sustaining themselves, by making these kind of oases, they drew other people in. Villages existed in the shadow of the monastery. So it wasn't just a matter for the monks. They sustained lay people and families that were all kind of nourished by the commitment they'd made to God. So similarly for us, I kind of think of it, as how do we be a channel of grace? And a channel has to be open at both ends. You know, we have to be deeply rooted in God and open to what he's calling us to do, what he's asking us to amend in our own lives. And then as long as we're deeply rooted in God, we have to then consider how are we open to the world so that what we receive, we can pass on to others.
Mm-hmm. Amen. And so in your own book, could you talk a little bit about sort of your thesis and how you sought to build on that? So what was the purpose then of you following up Rod's book with your own?
I feel like a lot of what Rod was doing was pitching people on community as a project. Yeah. He was often pitching people who'd kind of invested a lot of their Christian identity into politics. So, really making the case there are ways to make a difference that aren't limited to how you vote, which is important. It's an important part of being a responsible citizen and a responsible steward, but it's hardly the end of how we care for the community around us. So Rod was making the pitch of why care about this.
Right.
My book kind of presumes you do at that point. I kind of thank him for preparing the ground. And then my project is over the next 2 weeks to 2 months, exactly where you are, what can you do to grow closer to God and move deeper into community? Because I think a lot of people have a kind of wish list of, once I, have a job that I expect to hold for 5 years. Once we buy a house, once I get married, I'll be able to do this.
Once the house is clean, I can have people.
Exactly. But these kind of things that push community into the future and make it feel like we have to graduate into being able to care for others. When we're called to care for people exactly as we are and exactly where we are, our options may expand, but there's always something that's open to us.
Right. That's really beautiful too. I think that the immediacy, the feeling of immediacy, that this is something that is here and it's already now, and we can we can participate in building that. A lot of people I talk to, when they hear Benedict option, it's kind of also become like kind of a key phrase of warning cult or warning, we are circling the wagons. And for some people, it's very attractive. And for others, they're like, that's not Catholic. So is the Benedict option, the walled monastery, the circling of the wagons?
No, or at least it shouldn't be. I think some people are attracted to that idea, and some people hate that idea and kind of castigate the whole discourse around it for that reason. Right. But here's kind of the test you can rely on. Mm-hmm. You can't form a pure community because it will have sinners in it. And if people talk about their attraction to this as an escape from the world or a chance to kind of be around only people who will be good for them, then you know they've kind of gotten a little delusional about original sin in the first place. Even within a Christian community, we'll hurt each other, we'll fail mm-hmm. each other, we'll let God down. And when we turn to sin, even in small things, it's about supporting each other in the struggle to be good, not about creating a group of people who are good already.
Amen. Amen. So kind of along those lines, then when you're building these communities, and we'll get into more like concrete suggestions in a minute, but you know, considering the fallenness of humans and, you know, as I grow older, and I know a lot of homeschoolers have experienced the coming together of homeschool communities and the fragmentation of those communities. And it's like a bad divorce, right? I mean, a lot of us experienced divorce in our own families or with our friends' families. And when Catholic communities tear apart, it's devastating with the added gravitas of like the scandal, right? Especially to children. So I guess my question is, and I ask myself this whenever, you know, looking at building community, is how do you make it sustainable? What are the sort of the dangers to be aware of? And where do you find the courage to go forward anyway?
I think one goal is that from the start, it's not given to us to know that a community we create will be permanent or that an institution we start is meant to last forever. Even when God is calling us to do something, he doesn't always tell us for how long he expects us to do it. Mm-hmm. I'm really moved by the story of Meg Hunter-Kilmer, who's a Catholic writer, who got what she felt like a very strong call to enter the convent, and then received in the process of her discernment a really strong word from God to leave. And she doesn't, you know, there are fruits that were born from that, but it's not something where she feels like, wow, I have total and complete peace with the way God pulled me all over the place, you know, from moment to moment.
Right.
So these communities, it's sufficient to do well and to treat each other kindly, but we don't know that they'll last forever. So I think it's less that we start from the planning of how do I make sure this is sustainable, versus how do we make sure that, you know, if it fails, it fails kindly and gently, that it may turn out God calls you to create a homeschooling co-op with a group of parents for a year, and then things change or people move and you can't sustain it ultimately. Yeah. And how do you make sure that's not a question of being angry with each other or feeling like you failed if it was a good year and it bore good fruit?
Right. Yeah. And I think often too, just in the history of the church, of all the religious orders that have come and gone, right? So we have like the great pillars with the Dominicans and the Franciscans, Carmelite, and all the big pillars. And even those, I mean, they've gone through many iterations of struggle and conflict and reform, which, you know, meant reform also meant like falling away and all of that, and but also many religious orders that we don't know of anymore and that we have very few records of. And that idea was, well, was it worth it? And I think the answer needs to be, you know, God knows, and we try and follow him from moment to moment and day to day and choice to choice. And when we seem to have failed, we give that over to him as well. I'm reading I Believe in Love for Lent by Father Albe, and he talks a lot about the idea of empty hands and bringing those to God as well.
I think there's an amazing example in the life of Saint Raphael Arnaiz-Barron, who's the first canonized Trappist saint, who's writings in English are forthcoming in translation for the first time by my daughter's godmother. So I'm very excited. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I've just really been entering into spiritual writings because I get to see some of them early. Catherine Addington sends them to me. But he's a saint who failed, you know, in everything he wanted. You know, he wanted to be a Trappist monk. And because of his diabetes, he was never healthy enough to make full vows or live out the full life of a monk. He became an oblate, which usually was reserved to people who were in some way illiterate or unfit to be priests. And he died very young. Mm. And he's a saint, you know, and he has these beautiful spiritual writings, but God called him into the cloister and then didn't give him what he thought he was being called to. Yeah. I think that's true for all of us, especially in kind of the more up in the air, you know, he knew what a Trappist was. We don't know exactly what we're being called to be.
Right, what we're building, right?
Yeah. So it can be really hard to see God kind of change the plan on us. But if we're faithful to him, if we spend time with him in prayer, if we're willing to do whatever work is put in front of us, we can trust that that is pleasing to God, even if it's not always pleasing to us.
Yes. Yes, it's not always feeling good, that's for sure. I was thinking of one more example. Alice von Hildebrand, she wrote her autobiography as Memoirs of a Happy Failure, which is exactly sort of like, let's be happy failures. And she and her husband built this amazing community in New York City. But she always felt very much that her efforts were constantly being frustrated. And she ended, you know, her life was completely subordinated to the project of upbuilding her husband's great work, which was a noble task, but she definitely looked at herself as a happy failure because she found that happiness in surrendering it to God and letting him build the community and the relationships and letting them go where they would. So that's another good one if people are looking for a book about failure. All right, so let's go up into the family now and talk about, I think this ties in a lot with what you're doing over at Other Feminisms with interdependence too, but how can Catholic families bring these ideas into their homes and their lives, practically speaking? So what's the 2-week plan, Mrs. Sargent?
The biggest one is to invite someone over to your house when your house isn't totally clean or everything isn't totally polished, or when you're having takeout instead of cooking, you know. But just to set that norm both for yourself and for your guests that it's enough to be together if your guest is a Christian to pray together without everything else working well. I think it's a big place where Catholic families have a great witness to offer, because when you look at why our culture is so frightened of children, you know, people are afraid because they feel responsible for children. They think, because a child is so important, it's not that our culture doesn't value children. They go, because a child is so important, I can't have one until everything else in my life is settled. Yeah. And I can't have another. You know, if my house is ever messy now, it proves that everything will fall apart. So when a big family invites someone in and you see a family that's joyful and messy and that everything isn't perfectly put together, and that the children and parents can be happy in the midst of that. That's an incredible pro-life witness, and it's a message people don't hear almost anywhere else.
Yeah, I agree. And I think too that for the family, for the children, I know in our family, we've had, you know, periods where we have people over and I feel like it was just, I was yelling the whole time because like the children were running around stripping off clothing or something like that. Or like, you know, we dropped 3 things in the kitchen and, you know, afterwards, I think the children's feedback being like, that was wonderful. And the idea that they, showing to them as they grow up that, okay, a home is an open place. It's not just our little nucleus where we keep things, you know, we hide all of our foibles behind these walls and then we go out in the world and present this nice picture. But our home is a porous, you know, people come in through the doors and the windows and sometimes down the chimney and with my 4-year-old. And that children growing up with that understanding of a home rather than being an enclosed place where you hide everything that you don't want people to see, that it's something where the world can come and see, is just healthy. And it sets them up in future to be able to be welcoming themselves or to feel comfortable being welcomed by others. Something
it
else
also,
that
I think it also just teaches us something about who we are in relation to God, right? Yeah. We can hide our messy homes from our friends. We can't hide our messy souls from God.
Nope.
And the more experience we have inviting people into what's a little messy or imperfect in our life and being loved and having that be a part of our relationship, not a private part or a secret part. You know, I hope the easier it is to go to confession and put what we're most ashamed of in front of God instead of staying away from the church or staying away from the sacraments because we're ashamed of what we'd have to show him as though we're telling him for the first time about our sins when we go
before.
To confession.
Yeah.
Like, no one tell God I've done this, but...
Yeah, I think that's very true. Something that I like to encourage families to do as well is have priests over. And I know, again, like I'm always surprised talking to people that there's still this reservation about, oh, the priest is coming over and like my kids, you know, or the house or the food or, but I think a lot of like the past 20 years with the scandals and the I almost feel like the danger is that we won't grow from all of this horribleness that we've been uncovering in the church. We won't grow from it until lay people start to reach out to priests who are feeling embarrassed or feeling ashamed or feeling alone and just have them over for dinner. And yes, it's loud. It probably will confirm them in their choice of celibacy. I've had several priests tell me after a very loud dinner that, wow, I'm going to go home to my very quiet priory or rectory. But having them over too, just helping them to realize that families are just people and helping us to realize that priests are people. And like you said, it doesn't have to be perfect. There doesn't need to be this reservation in our relationship. So have priests over too.
Yeah. I think it is a continuing wound from the sexual abuse crisis within the church that, you know, some things that would be the sign of a wholesome, you know, growth in love are things that parents do feel nervous about, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if I bring the priest over and my kids get attached to him, you know, what would I let them do with the priest, you know, by himself and what wouldn't I? And I think a family dinner is a very safe space, but then you kind of do want to keep up those conversations, not just about priests, but about anyone so that your kids know it's okay to say no to an adult. You know, if an adult tells you to keep secrets, that's not something a grown-up can ask you to do. Mm-hmm. And you kind of want to build up both that sense of your children's sense of what's right and that they can be brave and say no to someone and that you'll trust them. Mm-hmm. And then also to be able to have greater intimacy with people in the church and elsewhere, kind of buoyed by that reinforcement elsewhere.
Right.
And I do think, you know, priests like noisy dinners in many cases because with the clerical shortage in America, a lot of priests live on their own who never would have had such a lonely life otherwise. They live in a rectory with three other priests as brothers. Right. And then they do go home to a quiet rectory every night unless they're called out because someone is dying.
Right. And that's when you get out. And it can really wear you down. Yeah. And I think too, I mean, my experience is the priests with whom we can have the healthiest relationships already have a lot of those boundaries up, and you know, many, many boundaries up, and would be happy to talk to parents about how do we not only protect your children but protect the priest as well, and just that healthy openness to that conversation, because I mean, heaven knows they've been having those conversations now for 20 years with their fellow priests and their bishops and their HR departments and all that. So having them with actual families in a loving, charitable way that builds up the relationship is so, so worth it and so necessary. So what would you say is the role for parents? And of course, your child, you're probably wondering these things as well, but what would you say is the role of education and educational communities or choices in building the Benedict option?
I think so much of education isn't just about, you know, learning a set of facts. It's about forming character and setting our disposition towards the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an enormous math nerd, and I really hope Beatrice is into mathematics. But the thing that's behind mathematics is, you know, an awe at beauty, an awe at truth, and the way these two are intermingled. And for anyone who doesn't think that's what's at the heart of mathematics, you had a lousy math teacher.
Yes. You know? Go back.
Math is the kind of awe at transcendence you get to teach even in secular public school, mm-hmm. right? It's mm-hmm. allowed. You get to really have moments of startling, piercing beauty.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of education is all about that, about how do we encounter the world? Mm-hmm. How do we respond to it? And what do we seek out? How do we, you know, how do we digest it? And that's the thing, even at 14 months, my daughter's very good at. She's interested in the world. She's fascinated by it. She wants to put it all in her mouth. And in many ways, education is the process of nurturing and then just shaping that instinct.
Yes.
But that hunger and that delight in the goodness of creation and knowing the goodness of what God has made is what education is meant to bring out and refine. Mm-hmm. But every student should kind of retain that hunger my 14-month-old has.
Yes.
It's just a question of tempering it slightly.
Giving it a few structures mm-hmm. in which to channel it. Yeah, I taught high school geometry for several years, and I used to tell them it's a theology course because you really are touching the divine when you see those pure truths. And I think too, education, when people look at it, the way that you're describing, it says, you know, there's this natural desire to know and to grow in knowledge that in the context of relationship with adults or older, you know, older students who have been there before, in the context of relationship, we learn how to grow in knowledge and how to come closer to the true, the good, the beautiful. I do think that, you know, Benedict option communities, this is one of the reasons why the monasteries themselves, right, had schools, and they were the only schools in Europe, that kind of intimacy of discovering truth together is a solid community. And so, yeah, I think education happens best in Benedict option kind of communities where people are drawn together by this common thirst.
And I think there's a big blessing when there's a real diversity, even in skill and intellect there, mm-hmm. right? That
yes.
It's a really tough thing. I came up through public schools with a very, you know, academically good school, but that meant there was a lot of tracking, a lot of focus on achievement testing. And tests. Exactly. And so, you know, a real sense of that our worth is grounded in that mm-hmm. rather than our worth is in our, you know, character, our disposition towards learning. You know, my husband was homeschooled and had, you know, a kind of smaller homeschooling co-op and a lot more ages who were all intermingling together. Mm-hmm. I think a big blessing of that is you get to see, you know, some younger kids who are better than you at something, some older kids who you're better at something, that just this less of the sense that you're being graded against your exact peers and that's a mm-hmm. really meaningful part of your identity.
Yeah.
I think that's really sad, and it means that even as you're learning, you know, grammar, you're also learning an untruth about who you are. Mm-hmm. And I think you can move away from that even in the context of a, you know, totally age segregated group, but it's harder. Yeah. And in a monastery, everyone knows who they are. They're monks, you know, they're called to be saints.
Yes.
But there can be a lot of differences among them that aren't as relevant mm-hmm. beyond that shared vocation.
Yeah. I think the binding with vows in the monastery allows for, right, that grounding in the vows and the unity around the truth of Jesus Christ allows for that diversity to be non-destructive, right? That, I mean, we see so much right now in our culture. This is 2021 for those watching from the future. we see a lot of themes of diversity being destructive, and maybe even years of emphasizing diversity, multiculturalism, now producing this sort of tribalism, right? The other extreme. And I think when a community is bonded together in truth and not vows, because we're not monks, we're a family, then we have to find something true that brings us together and carries us and makes the diversity fruitful rather than destructive. So what do you think those binding ties are for a community of families or a parish? And how can we, what are some concrete binding practices that help with that differences of life, temperament, math skill? level.
It's funny because, you know, to an extent, we're always just reinventing Christianity itself, which I think is understandable.
It's what people do, right? We reinvent the real.
It's similar to the new evangelization, which, you know, was both powerful, but not actually that novel. Right. The Benedict option isn't a breakthrough in theology. It's just that we build up these kind of immunities to being told the Christian story and mm-hmm. our Christian duty as we get used to hearing it. And then someone puts a new name on it. That's really most of what I'm doing.
Cool. Yeah, yeah.
And reminds us of it. And suddenly we're reinvigorated.
Yes.
So I think the first thing is just a shared life of prayer. It's very boring. It's the obvious answer. And yet, because it's obvious, we kind of put it last behind whatever feels most novel. So you can give it its own name, if that helps. But when you come together with your community or your group of families, you know, how is it you can have a shared life of prayer? And that might mean all the families get together for adoration once a week at your parish, you know, and have a shared holy hour that's for the intentions of your whole group. And it might mean, you know, we have a really diffuse group and not everyone can commit to that. And it might mean we just have a group text of prayer requests so that it's easy for us to rely on each other. And people kind of put together a monthly spiritual bouquet for each other's intentions and everyone's doing it separately in their own families. It might mean we kind of put our whole project under the patronage of a particular saint. And we all go out and get an image of them together. We get them blessed by our priests together. And we put them all up in our home classrooms so that as we pray, whenever we see that, we're thinking of the other people who have also been placed under, let's say, St. Edith Stein's protection.
I'll go with her.
But I think so much what I want is a daily reminder of some kind to pray for these people and to remember that they're praying for me.
Yeah.
And everything starts with that. And then beyond that, you can kind of get to that, oh, do we want some kind of covenant for our group?
Yeah.
Or it's not really binding in any particular sense. Do we want a mission statement? But it starts with prayer. And then we can kind of give voice to the things we've received in prayer in those other ways.
I agree. I think starting with the conversation with God and bringing him into the conversation is the binding tie. And it's why all of the church's movements, you know, centered on that. And yeah, like you said, they package it in different ways. Thinking of Opus Dei has circles and, you know, the monasteries have vows and yeah, it's all just different. But yeah, I'm trying to think of like cool names now for prayer. What's a cool name? Like the newest.
I mean, sodalities are the coolest names for organizations of lay people. Yes. So call your organization the Sodality of St. Edith Stein.
There you go. The confraternity of... Who is the Trappist guy?
St. Raphael Arnaiz Baron.
There you go.
But of course, the secret thing is you can just ask a saint to help you. But if you give it a formal name and make it a formal process, it's a crutch. It helps us, you know, build our lives around this.
Yes. And definitely don't let a lack of creativity stop you from just taking the first step. Like,
yes.
Well, we couldn't think of a name for it. So,
well, this is what I love about the historical practice of the Angelus. So you know, it's a moment of prayer that kind of cuts through the day historically. Yes. The bells would ring and everyone in town knew that it was time to pray and you knew that everyone else was praying.
Yeah.
And again, that's a thing you can do in a community of families. You know, we're lucky enough.
Your phone.
Yeah.
Everyone's phone goes off at noon.
We live right by our parish, so we hear the bells at noon and we pray right then. But before that, when we lived in New York, we didn't. And we just had a group text again of a few other families that we cared about. And we just, whoever remembered would send a text of Angelus, bell emoji. So it lacks the dignity and formality of the bells. But it meant we all prayed together.
Exactly.
And whatever takes you closer to prayer with others is worth it. You can always build on it later or expand it later, but start somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I think too, I've known a lot of homeschool communities that persist have, and just family communities and parishes are centered somehow also on the works of mercy. The traditional works of the church, and I love them because, like you said, you don't have to reinvent anything. Like, they're just listed there. There's seven corporal, seven spiritual, and there are ways of doing each one that can be adapted to any age of any human person and any family context. You don't have to go down to soup kitchens if you have all young children who it's not safe for them to go down to soup kitchens. And there are other ways to feed the hungry. literally in your own home with your toddler, you'd be feeding the hungry every day, but to find a way for a community to practice a work of mercy together can also be just really effective in the ties that bind, right, through the difficult times.
And I think it's important as a check on our own arrogance and pride also, that it's easy to kind of get involved and I've got this really cool curriculum and I've come up with something novel and I'm going to, you know, just, I'm going to revitalize the whole church through myself, you know, and then there's, well, actually also you should make sandwiches for people who are hungry. Yeah. And there will be that voice sometimes if you're a big dynamo, and I have this problem where you're like, oh, but anyone can make sandwiches. I want to do something cool.
Yeah.
God doesn't need us to be extraordinary in the eyes of the world, and if we only have our own interesting projects, we're often neglecting the very simple work he's put in front of us. So I think a community should have some practice of the works of mercy, you know, as very simply understood. Don't overcomplicate it. Don't come up with something brilliant.
Right. I'm going to write a book about them. Yeah. Yep. That's the intellectual temptation. It's like, but I have very important intellectual work to do. I can't make your sandwich right now, dear. You know,
this was a challenge for me as a new convert, because when I wanted to pray the rosary, I really felt like, okay, well, when I contemplate the mysteries, should I be trying to wrest new insights out of them? You know, should I be trying to tell God something new about his
about himself? Yeah.
It's crazy once you say it out loud, but it's amazing how many things you can think like that in the privacy of your own head. And it's not until you're explaining to someone else what you're doing, you're like, that's a little nuts. You know, I think God just wants me to spend time with him, and I should be responsive to what he wants here rather than trying to come up with something to dazzle him.
Yes. He's not too dazzled, I think, by me. Yeah, I know. Sometimes I'll be praying the rosary and I'll be like, you know, I've just been kind of saying this rotely, and if that's a word, rotely, and I haven't had a deep thought in about 3 decades. It must not be a good day for the rosary. And I just like give up. That's like completely the wrong way to look at it. It's just the being together. And I think it's like that with this idea of building small communities where God has put us. It's just the being together, and nothing is too small of a gesture. Like if you're just, you know, talking after Mass one Sunday and a family, you know, you can tell the mom's having a hard time, or maybe they just, you know, found out dad lost his job or something. Like it doesn't cost us anything to say, why don't you just come over for dinner tonight? You know, if, as long as you don't have pressing obligations, obviously, but just that openness to that kind of movement in the spirit and that kindness. It doesn't have to be fancy. You don't have to have deep insight and like you're going to fix all their problems, but just to be together in your homes.
I think it's such a blessing just to be mindful at Mass of other families there, especially as we move out of the pandemic and things get a little more open. You know, when you see a family that's kind of had a tough time with a kid who's had a meltdown, to go over and introduce yourself and say something nice to them, so that it's not just, you know, a sense that they're being tolerated at Mass, but actively welcomed. Mm-hmm. And I guess we think of families as the people who need the most support at Mass, but, you know, to be a little attentive to the single people who might be looking at your family, hoping this will be them someday, and not knowing how, especially as, you know, the whole dating situation gets more and more messy and there are more and more bad examples to try and navigate past. So I know that as a single woman, I would look at children and just wish to meet them, because my friends weren't married. No one had children. I didn't see any children. And there can be a real gift in just, if you see someone waving to your baby, going over and introducing yourself, letting them hold your baby for a little bit, and just really letting the blessings God gives you spill over, including in ways you don't expect. You can be the family whose child had a meltdown in Mass, and there still may be someone who wants to hold that baby, not to help you, simply because babies are good.
Yes, and they're rare. They're increasingly rare. Yeah, I think I said I was going to bring up pronatalism, but when we were arranging to talk, I had just watched the Plow symposium with Ross Douthat and yourself, Sarah Williams, Anna Sussman. It was really great. So if anyone hasn't seen it, you should go Google, search in YouTube for the Plow pronatalism. I forget what it was called, but it was
the case
really good.
For one more child.
The case for one more child. Thank you, Ross. Yes. And it seems to me, as I was watching it, I was like, it seems to me that this idea of pronatalism and encouraging American and all families to have the courage to go from we're having two children to having three, we had three to having four. It seems that Catholic families being willing to put themselves out there and invite those young people, single, newly married couples into their homes is a big part in the case for one more child.
Absolutely. You know, people need the example. There's a remark by Senator Ben Sasse where he was at a dinner where people are talking about, you know, when have people grown up? What is it that makes someone a grown up?
Yeah.
And Sasse said, you know, you're a grown up when, you know, you can be left in charge of a 2-year-old for 2 hours without that being a problem. And he said he saw some of the other men at the table, like, kind of go white at that, including people who had children, right? So, you know, there's a sense of it is hard to grow up all the way if you're not entrusted with certain responsibilities, yes. If a baby is a hypothetical threat rather mm-hmm. than a lived reality.
Right.
You know, and I said for a bit, my friends hadn't had kids when I was kind of wanting to know kids and hold them. But there was one big exception. One of my friends had got married and had a kid just barely a year out of college, which was pretty unusual in our social situation. And what happened was not only did we all like her kids a bunch, she's just had her fourth now.
Oh,
but one of her friends, when he got married, said to her, you know, every time we see your daughter, my wife and I move up our timeline for having children by 6 months. Oh,
that's awesome.
And
that's
he's had his second kid now, but it took the reality of a child to really, you know, feel not equal to one exactly, but prepared for one, you know, realizing you are grown up enough to do this.
Yeah.
And then it takes having a child of your own to go, I turns out I want more.
Yes. You know,
in the abstract, there's very little difference between two children and three children if they're abstract imaginary children.
Yes.
It's that sense of,
well, they're a spreadsheet and it's a money calculation almost. Like, could I afford this? Or then I only have so many years of empty nesting if I have a child at this age. And then you actually get a baby and you're like, wait, this is not a spreadsheet. Smells worse. And man, it's cute. And yeah.
I think people get kind of unfairly dinged for being selfish when what they are is they're trying to be prudent with only one side of the data, that numbers side available to them.
Right.
And babies themselves are data. People need that lived experience with babies to be fully informed about what babies are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I know for us, when we were a young couple and just had our first, it was the experience of watching another family. Also, they were devout Catholics, and they were on their third baby in graduate school. And I think my husband and I, when we were thinking graduate school, we were like, maybe one, you know, and the generosity that we knew God was asking of us was very frightening. But being with this other couple and seeing them just be generous and accept whatever came, it gave us the moral courage to do that. And it's, again, that there is moral courage in community. And when the people in the community are open to God and, you know, all trying to do what he's telling them, not that we always know, but there's that growth of virtue. It's contagious virtue, right?
And I think creating community among families also reminds us that big families get even bigger, you know, not just in terms of the number of children, but in terms of the number of people who love those children, who play a role in bringing them up, you know, in part because you're forced to it, right? The more children you have, the harder it is to kind of keep everything private or try and do it by yourself.
Yeah.
I think during the pandemic, you know, there are folks who've had a really tough time because they've had a new baby or you know, they have a child with special needs and they're on their own. You know, it's not been safe for families to visit. You know, they have had to kind of close up the doors, especially if they have a child with health issues who was at greater risk. And so for those families, the pandemic has been a very lonely, isolating time.
Yeah.
But for a lot of families, that's their experience all the time, not because of fear of outside contamination, but because they don't have a community to be part of and they don't know who to ask. One of the women who kind of participates in the conversations in my other feminisms community, we were talking about when you ask things of others. And she said she had a really difficult time during one of her pregnancies where she just didn't know who she would ask to watch her other kids when she needed to go to the hospital with her husband. And they kind of had to juggle everything And it was harder even to have him with her for the labor because they weren't sure who to rely on to watch their other kids.
Wow.
And she felt like later there probably were people in her community who were willing to do that, but she didn't know who they were. Mm-hmm. They hadn't had those kind of small interactions that made it clear you can ask in an emergency.
Ask the big thing, right? Yeah.
And so in all those small things we do for each other, you know, we don't know who around us has a big secret thing they need help with and they haven't figured out who they can ask for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And just those simple gestures of, you know, it was great to see you at Mass today. Can I talk to your kids? Or, you know, how are you doing? Or I know my husband, he loves to just ask questions because he's so curious about other people. And so whenever there's like a new family in the parish, he's like you're going to go find out everything about them. But, you know, getting just saying, you know, would you, if you ever need anything, you know, you're new to the area, if you need to just text, like, here's my wife's cell phone number because she's home. And he's, Erica, come give me your cell phone number. And just like that kind of those little interactions, like, we're here for you. I remember that for me, that really came home. I just had our third child and we'd moved. We were in Podunk, Western Massachusetts. My husband was at UMass Amherst in a postdoc. And I ended up with a terrible postpartum depression, severe back pain. And we really needed help, but we were still 4 hours from our families. And the local parish was not one where, you know, you just see a bunch of people. And finally, I mean, just in desperation, we just went to the priest and said, we need help. Like, my husband has to work all these hours, 60 hours a week. I'm home with three small children. And it was very humiliating, but he gave us the number of several older couples whose children were all moved away. And they started coming over just, you know, what they rotated like 3 days a week. We'd have someone in for just the morning so I could do PT and they would do some cleaning and just be, color with the kids or take them outside. And that moment of like severe being way down and humiliation and having to ask when we didn't know anyone, it ended up being such a gift for us, obviously materially, but the older couples too were like, we're so excited that you asked somebody because they, you know, they wanted to help. And it's kind of the lesson learned that, that it was just, it was a good, it was good to have to ask, I guess, is what I'm saying. And it's okay to have to ask.
And that goes back honestly to the fruit that can be born out of having the priest over, what you were talking about, that it's really natural that we want to turn to the church and turn to the priest to say, I need help, but I don't know who to ask. Will you ask Father?
Yes.
You know, you're the pastor here. You must know.
You're the dad.
Who can help, right? You know everyone. Yep. But priests don't know everyone all the time. It kind of takes us making ourselves available for a priest to be able to say, that couple, you know, I had dinner with the other week. Mm-hmm. They're the ones I should ask for you. Mm-hmm. When I came into the church, one of the priests who kind of helped me, Father Thomas Joseph White, picked me.
I'm a fangirl.
He's wonderful. You know, he's a wonderful scholar and then
plays the banjo.
Musician. Yes. Yep. But then in terms of what pastoral care looked like from him, you know, when I decided to become Catholic, he said, well, you know, you'll go to this parish because they run two cycles of RCIA a year, so you won't have to wait as long.
Yes.
Good. He's like, and you know, Sarah will be your friend there. You know, I'll introduce you. And she is my friend. You know, but I was so grateful for that.
Yes. And he knew that because he knew Sarah. And to you, and he connected you, and it's awesome. It's really awesome.
And the more we make ourselves available, you know, the more we're acknowledging God's plans are greater than our plans. Those small contacts, though, sharing our own prayer requests is one of the big things I do. So when I'm with another Christian, I don't want to part from them without praying together, or at least asking, what can I pray for you? And that always involves a little self-disclosure because the things we most want other people to pray for are often personal.
They're very vulnerable. Yeah.
But it's those moments we kind of build on and give room for the Holy Spirit to act, to go beyond what we think we have to offer, what we think other people need, to let ourselves be used as God's instruments. And that really takes us so far beyond our own strengths.
Right. And I think, I just lost my train of thought. The coffee's running out. The caffeine's like, I guess I was gonna just close before I ask you to talk about the Lord of the Rings, because I love them. We can just geek out for a little bit. I guess the last thing would be, what would you say to someone who has maybe been in a community and been very hurt or scandalized by that? You know, Catholic community would be kind of the worst hurt, right? Because you feel that these people should always be kind and my friends. So what would you say to someone who's sort of lost their community and is hesitant to rebuild that Benedict option in their own lives or join another?
I think taking things slow can be the right approach. You know, and a good, healthy community will be patient with you and gentle with you.
Mm-hmm.
A community that's kind of pressuring you to make commitments you're not ready for, you know, anyone who kind of presumes to speak for God to you, right? That sense of, oh, if you have doubts, that's automatically from the devil. You know, yes. If you're not willing to put time in, you know, that's because you're mired in sin. Those people are not speaking for God.
Right.
You know? No other person can kind of lay those burdens on you or tell you God's will for your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not bound by that. You can walk away. So if you find yourself in another community, you know, tell people you want to move slowly. And if they don't respect that, that is on them, you know, and they're unfortunately kind of laying burdens in your path and will account for themselves to God.
Mm-hmm.
God is always with the person who was wounded.
Yes.
God is always with the victim of abuse. You know, mm-hmm. the end of the story is written, and it is Christ triumphant over every wound, transfiguring them in his own passion. And in the meantime, that's healing is very difficult. You know, going through Christ's passion with him is very difficult. No matter what wounds you've suffered, God has something for you to do to become a saint. Mm-hmm. And it may mean withdrawing from some of the other openings or opportunities that feel more natural to others.
Right.
But, you know, God makes saints out of, you know, nuns and monks in enclosure, you know, in very private parts of community who are just alone with him. God makes saints out of busy parents like Zélie and Louis Martin. God can make a saint of anyone as long as they're willing to be with him. And mm-hmm. I think the more you're kind of struggling with a very bad experience, the more you want to find someone in the church who has that faith that God wants to make a saint of you and is just curious how, rather than telling you what you need to do.
That's beautiful. It's so true. Yeah, and thank you for that. Because I know it's always a question with families who are looking to homeschool, how will I find community? And if I do, will it be like last time? And it's very important to remember that. And also that if you've been hurt, as you reopen and as your wounds heal, God, that woundedness, like you said, the resurrection, the wounds are resurrected, and they will be the source of strength for others as well. And that conviction is so true. Thank you so much. But we can't go yet because I love fairy tales and you love fairy tales. And you have a fun project that I would like to have you tell people about, because we have a lot of families with high schoolers who also love fairy tales and the Lord of the Rings. And can you just tell us about this amazing project coming up?
Sure. So it's the first, my husband designs games just as, you know, a freelance project. And this is the first game I've written with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Back Again from the Broken Land. And it's a storytelling game. It kind of tells the story of a group of small adventurers walking home after a big war.
Mm-hmm.
So you can almost think of it, it's like, you know, at the end of The Hobbit as they go home, Lord of the Rings as they go home and face the scouring of the Shire.
Mm-hmm.
In the eyes of the world, the story has ended by the time your game begins. The Doomslord has been defeated. Victory is ours. And the game is really focused on the way that even after a victory is ultimately won, we have to reckon with the costs of it and really live out what was won. In some ways, it's a game about, you know, fully entering into Christ's passion and resurrection, where the victory is won. But how is it that we let that victory be won in our own individual lives? Mm-hmm. And so kind of, you know, off of what we were just discussing about people reckoning with wounds, the main thing of the game is that the characters all start with burdens that are mm-hmm. unnamed.
Mm-hmm.
And the journey home is a time for them to try and name, reckon with, and ultimately release those burdens, be willing to set them down, be willing to hand them over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the challenge. They also have to make sure they don't get caught by the Doomslord's hunters who will kill them.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, there's kind of a physical peril as well. But the game is fundamentally about that spiritual mm-hmm. journey and the way that they support each other to really, to be healed and to be ready to return home and enter into their community mm-hmm. again, changed by their journey, but not ultimately making something from their wounds rather than being consumed wonderful. By them.
That sounds great. I want like every high school student to play this game. So maybe we'll have a Benedict option there and back again club here at our house next year. So where is this game? How can we get it?
So if you just Google Back Again from the Broken Land, mm-hmm. it should come right up. We ran it on Kickstarter, which means that mm-hmm. initial funding period is over, but we're going to have pre-orders and ways to sign up, including just to play test it. So if you're interested in it and want to help us make sure we've got all the kinks out before we go to press, you can help out.
Oh, we would love to. I have a bunch of people who love to play games up here in Connecticut. Any other projects that you want to share with us that exciting?
I think the big one I'd want to invite people into is my other feminism mm-hmm. Substack. So definitely. It's a newsletter that I really try and run like a community. Every Monday we have a prompt for discussion. And then every, you know, Thursday the following week, I share highlights from the group's discussion. It's mm-hmm. meant to be a place for people to come together just to advocate for women as women, especially mm-hmm. in a culture that often treats women like deficient men
yep.
and expects us to change ourselves to make us easier to accommodate, whether that's, you know, by using, you know, contraception to suppress our hormonal cycles and calling that kind of a cure for being a woman, or whether that's just facing a world that, you know, sizes tools for men's hands instead of women's hands. Just being attentive to all those ways the world says no to being a woman and supporting mm-hmm. each other and saying yes.
I love it. So check that out. We are going to put links to all of Leah's projects, especially Other Feminisms and The Game, down in the video description. So Leah Labresco Sargent, thank you so much for your
time. Thank you for having me. And I really look forward to coming up to New Haven again mm-hmm. to have in-person community with you.
I can't wait. And the kids can't wait either. We have fangirls over here.
Aw, excellent.